there's an extra clip in there for you guys. From an old episode.
Oh, my gosh.
I fat fingered it. My bad. Hey, guys. Welcome to Overcrest. I'm Chris.
And I'm Jake.
And we have a fun episode for you guys today. I learned a lot. I learned a lot talking to Ryan about the Skyline GTR.
Yes, which I love this because this is outside of your wheelhouse, right? Anything
big
JDM
time.
And especially the GTR, and admittedly mine a little bit, but I like to claim that I know a lot, or I know a little about a lot, right? So I do appreciate and know quite a bit, I guess, about the JDM scene.
Yeah,
our
guest today is Ryan Zamalin. He's the author of Slow Car Fast and the book Cult of GTR, which is, I read a bunch of the book. He overnighted it to me so I could like read it.
And oh, that's awesome.
I read a ton of the book. I didn't really know what to expect about a book about like a single make of a car.
Right.
But I mean, he's right. I mean, it does have a cult following, especially after reading the book and finding out the influence that it had.
You know, I love my little history snippets, Chris, and okay. I figured it might be a good primer to basically talk about the history of the GTR itself.
Yeah, let's do
it. And then go
into
this, because admittedly, a lot of our audience is also not really necessarily JDM, maybe not. I don't know. Some people don't know, right? So let's talk about the Nissan Skyline GTR. And to understand the origin of the GTR, you actually need to go back to 1950 with the origin of the Skyline model itself. Yeah,
I
now, interestingly...
when I think Skyline, I think like the early 70s was the one, like the...
No, 50s, 1954. And the original Skyline wasn't even made by Nissan. It was actually produced by a different Japanese manufacturer, Prince, which was known for their luxury vehicles.
Not Minnesota Prince. Not Purple
Prince. Not Minnesota Prince. They might have had a Purple Prince model, you know? And it's interesting, they did actually campaign some of these vehicles in the Japanese Touring Car Championship in the mid-60s to some success. But for the purposes of our story, we'll go right along here. In 1966, Prince and Nissan merged. And 2 years later, the third generation Skyline, which again was a Prince model, was released, this time under the Nissan name. It was only 2 years later that Nissan debuted a high-performance variant of the car at the Tokyo Motor Show, the Nissan Skyline 2000 GT Racer, or GTR for short.
Okay, hold on. I want to pull up a picture of this Skyline from the 60s so everybody can see it.
Well, first, let's look up the Prince.
Yeah, that's it. Prince Skyline. It's, I don't know.
Is that the one right there? I saw a
Prince
different
Skyline.
One. That's from the 60s. Go to the 50s.
Okay.
Like, these go way back, man.
Love,
and then let's
the
talk a little bit while
here.
You do that. Yeah, there it is.
Oh,
that
man.
Black one. Yeah, it looks like an American 50s car, right? Like, it's...
It does.
Maybe
it
little,
almost...
It looks like a
way,
55 Chevy is what it looks like in the front.
Yeah, at 80% scale.
Exactly.
Like it's
yeah,
like,
it's smaller.
Like scaled
right.
down.
Exactly.
It's scaled
yeah.
up.
So that is the original Skyline. And I think the important distinction here is people think GTR and they think Skyline, or they think Skyline and it must be a GTR. The Skyline was just a base model vehicle for Prince and then for Nissan for the longest time, right?
Yeah, it's
the
60
GTR
horsepower.
Was just the special edition. And so this first GTR in 1966, did I say? Yeah, featured a 2-liter straight six variant of Nissan's contemporary prototype racing engine at the time, the R380. The street version was codenamed the S20. That's the motor. That's the original Skyline motors, the S20. It had pretty impressive figures for the day. 4 valves per cylinder, dual overhead cams, triple carbs, and produced 160 horsepower at 7,000 RPM. This first-gen GTR was soon bestowed with the nickname of Hakusuka, which combines the Japanese word for box with an abbreviation of the Japanese pronunciation of Skyline. So it was like the Skyline box was the Hakusuka, and that's the first-gen GTR. The second-generation Skyline GTR followed in 1972, but with the oil crisis looming, Nissan canned all factory-backed racing programs, and with it, the GTR line, after only 197 of these second-gen cars were sold.
Ooh.
So
that's why these things go for big bucks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they'd not make many. And I really like these first, like the 1960s and 70s generations. Like,
yeah, they
they're
are
very cool, right?
They're killer. Look at these things. I mean, this is the fender mounted like mirrors.
They look a lot like, a Datsun 510 because it's very similar in same time period. They're very cool cars. Dope.
I don't know about this rear flare situation. I don't know about that.
Yeah, but they didn't originally have that.
Yeah, these are dope.
So as I said, you got to make the distinction.
Jake.
I know,
the
that's
triple...
what I'm talking about. That's the S20. It's like a really high-performance, cool motor.
Yeah, look
triple
at the headers are beautiful.
Side drafts.
Airbox
yeah.
is beautiful.
Yeah, that airbox is really cool, actually, for a factory.
Are these like Watanabes, these wheels?
Yes.
Oh,
they
man.
Are
Very
Watanabes,
cool.
which I was reading a whole thing. Was it you who sent me the history of the Mini Light Wheel? Someone
yes.
did.
Yes. Yeah, okay. It was me.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Because it is very interesting, the Mini Light, which we should yep. probably talk about. Regardless. Okay. So again, the distinction between the Skyline as a model and the GTR as a special edition. So production of the base Skyline continued and evolved. The performance GTR variant, however, wasn't revisited again until 1989 with the infamous R32 generation. So this new GTR set a precedent for the formula for all versions that would follow. It had all-wheel drive, a twin turbocharged six-cylinder, and in this case, it was the venerable RB26 motor. If you know anything about JDM lore or just Fast and the Furious movies, you've heard of the RB, right?
These guys have come on the rally with these things.
Oh, yeah.
R32. Yep.
Absolutely, they have. Nissan made up for lost time with the R32, featuring all manner of special models and various upgrades to go along with it, including the Nismo, which was a homologation special. They had the V-Spec, which commemorated the car's dominance in the Japanese Touring Car Championship. They had the V-Spec 2 for yet another JTCC championship, and the N1, which is basically a stripped-out lightweight version of the GTR. 1994 then saw the introduction of the R33 generation GTR, and it was basically an evolution of the R32 featuring the same motor and drivetrain.
I've never really heard anybody talk about the R33. I've only heard about the R32 and the R34.
The R33 is basically just another generation or an evolution of the R32. However, what made the R33 like vaulted to legendary status was its inclusion in the original Gran Turismo game. So this is where it kind of caught notoriety, right? Also notable was the running of the car, the 24 Hours of Le Mans, celebrated by a special edition LM model. In 1999, then we see the R34 generation GTR, which was released featuring an evolution, again, of the familiar running gear with the twin turbo RB engine, all-wheel drive, and a whole host of special editions to go with this one. It's interesting how many like Nismo and V-Spec and everything else additions they made of these. Fast forward to 2007 and the release of the R35 GTR. Now, the R35 was a break from tradition, Chris. No longer was this a performance variant of a Skyline standard model. Mm. It was a completely unique standalone car. Another break from tradition was the use of a twin turbo V6 as opposed to the prior inline sixes. And it was also the first version to be stolen.
Well, as big as that thing was and is, you need a little more power. There's getting it, making enough power out of that thing. It is big. Yeah. It's heavy. And you're not doing NA and having it be reliable.
Well, no, because everything from R32 on up was still twin turbo, six cylinder, but they're all inline sixes.
Oh, I understand what you're saying.
This is the V6. This is the first time they used the V6 with it.
This is how uneducated I am on these. I just don't know.
Yeah. So the original two gens were the naturally aspirated inline six cylinder. It was like rev happy, had really cool tech for the time. The R32, R33, and R34 are kind of all very similar. It used an inline six with twin turbochargers.
Okay? Gotcha.
And all wheel drive is when they introduced that in the R32. The
R35. These things are heavy. A brand new GTR. Is almost 4,000 pounds.
Yeah, I believe that for sure.
Wow. Even the 09s,
all-wheel drive,
3,800 pounds. And they're big. They're big girls.
They're
man.
Big cars. I mean, yep. And it was a standalone model. Like you can't just buy, they don't call it the Skyline anymore because it's not a Skyline. This is just the GTR. keep in mind, I mean, that's Skyline.
That's a shame, right?
Was a model, and the GTR was the Gran Turismo racing version of the Skyline.
You know what's
really
interesting
like.
Is you think what if this was Porsche, they would have called it a Skyline for sure. They would have appropriated that
because,
badge immediately.
Yeah. I think what you have to look at though, well, I don't know because I need to. I didn't look at do they still or did they still make the Skyline model in the rest of the world up until this point. I think they stopped production of the Skyline as a vehicle, and so they said, well, let's bring back the GTR badge. And just have a standalone vehicle.
This is where my lack of knowledge comes in. But I think they did have Skylines. But well, I don't have time to look this up right now. But
no, that's fine.
I think
it's interesting to note, you know, like we said, usually when you think Skyline, you think, oh, that must be a GTR. It's not. The Skyline is just the base model car that a GTR is based on up until the R35, which, by the way, was the first car that was actually sold stateside here, which is why you see them, and it kind of opened up an entirely new market.
Right.
So that is the quick and dirty history of the Nissan Skyline GTR.
All right, I'm going to show you a 2007 Skyline 370 GT. This is what
it
looks like.
370 GT.
This is it. They still made it.
Oh, that's just an Infiniti G37. That's all that is. But they call it a Skyline.
You're right.
Yep. Okay, interesting.
So they did mess with the badge names a little bit.
Yeah, so they sold it here as a Infiniti G37. Elsewhere, they called it a Skyline, which, again, it's sad. Why didn't they just bring it over then as a variation of that?
I don't know. There's a lot of questions. Why didn't they bring over that I had for Ryan? Like, why didn't they? What was the reason? And a lot of it is just the way that the Japanese culture was. Before we get into our interview with Ryan, what have you got for us?
Yeah, let's take a moment to talk about Petrolbox. And if you are a JDM fan, I don't really notate this in the ads, which I should. There are different versions of Petrolbox, which, of course, is the subscription, the monthly service made specifically for automotive enthusiasts, car guys, car girls in your life. When you sign up for it, you select, hey, are you primarily a European car guy? Are you a domestic guy? Or are you into JDM stuff? And so
hey,
if you're into GTR,
Do you think the muscle car guys look for 3/8 sockets like we look for 10mm sockets? Are there 3/8 sockets
missing?
I've
often wondered that. I don't think so, and I don't know why. I've never lost a 3/8.
Yeah, but you don't.
You know what it is? It's probably the half inch. Everything's half inch.
Yeah, but that's our 13. I don't lose the 13.
I know.
It's only the 10. The
right.
10 is the one that rolls
I think
away.
It's because
away.
It's the most common fastener on like. Any
no,
European
it's not,
car.
Though. The 13 is. Maybe it is the fact that it isn't the most common fastener. The 13 is. 13 mil is like everything
you're
is
right.
13. So then
Which
maybe it's the 10, you only use it every once in a while, so then you put it somewhere and then you don't use it again long enough that you've forgotten where you put it.
Well, hey, this is interesting because you know what Petrolbox has done? Several different months of subscription over the years, they've given their own custom branded 10mm sockets, which I think
just to make up for it.
Super cool. Yeah, each month they carefully select items, including tools like a 10mm socket, detailing supplies. Usually there's always a bottle of whether it's, you know, a tire dressing, interior detailer, a quick wax or a quick spray, quick detailer. I'll just say that. It's like Porky the Pig, where he's like, dab, 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 that's all, folks. That was me trying to say quick wax. Anyways, latest, greatest gear in the industry every single month. It makes a great gift. What?
Jake, red leather, yellow leather. Unique
red leather.
New York.
Red nope, baby not going to do that bumpers. Right now. Not at all. No, but there's two different levels to choose from. $20 a month, Petrolbox Premium, and then gets even more gear for $39.95 a month. You can check them out at mypetrolbox.com. You can also use the code Overcrest if you'd like to support the show and get a little money off on your order. The other sponsor that, of course, is into JDM market as well as all of the rest is CSF Cooling, who've been at the forefront of quality products for a fair price. They have a rich history stretching over 7 decades and provide the best high performance and OEM plus cooling systems on the market today. CSF offers over 3,000 different cooling applications for the most popular makes and models. Of course, from all of your Land Cruisers, Jeeps, Datsuns, the JDM stuff. Oop, Chris is pulling it up right there. I like it. They have new products all of the time. It should probably be over 3,000 and counting. They have vintage 80s Mercedes, BMW, Audi, Porsche, all the specialty stuff that probably is hard to find. And CSF, they have all of it right there. Check them out on csfrace.com or, of course, on Instagram, as Chris is looking at, I believe, right there. Yep. Or was that the website? I couldn't see.
That's Instagram, CSF underscore radiators.
There it is, CSF underscore radiators on Instagram. Check those guys out. Awesome products with, as we said, a huge application.
All right, guys. Let's bring on Ryan to talk about the cult of GTR. Yo, Ryan, how's it going, man? Thanks for joining us on the podcast.
It's going well, man. Thank you so much for having me.
How's the book coming along?
It's been really good. The reception has been strong, which I'm really, really happy about. And rollouts are always tricky. There's always unforeseen things that come up that you got to deal with on the fly. But this one has been really great. Just the enthusiasm and the passion is there for sure. So
that's probably because the car has a cult following. He wrote a book. So like anything with a cult following is going to have a little bit of a thing to it. So I've got to approach this as a little bit of a cynic and an ignoramus. Like, I'm not by any means a JDM guy. As you can see, there's Volkswagen Rabbits here. There's a 911 up there. I do have a Trooper, which I don't know if that makes me JDM or not, but I do have an Isuzu Trooper. But generally, things are like Porsche, Volkswagen, Mercedes. So I'm a little bit of an ignoramus. So I have to ask, I wrote some of these questions before I read a bunch of the book. By the way, great. It's great, man. Everybody, the link is in the bio link is in the bio for the podcast in the show notes. You can check it out. Please go check out his book. And I think after this interview, you'll want to do that. I thought, as a cynic, I go, why the cult of GTR? And why not cult of VW Golf or cult of Honda Civic or cult of Porsche 911? Because, I mean, the Porsche dudes are sycophantic, like, one make dudes, you know. So it's what you say in this book seems ubiquitous for any grassroots vein of many of the cars that I've owned. And like, fill me in, why cult of GTR? What is the inception of this book? Why does it exist?
Yeah, first of all, you're right. The level of enthusiasm is certainly not exclusive to the GTR. Like, it exists in lots of different car communities. I think what makes the Skyline GTR in particular stand out is the existence of the federal 25-year law, which states that any car that wasn't originally sold in the U.S. as new has to wait 25 years before it can come into the country. Now, there are some exceptions, which we go into a little bit in the book, but generally, you can't have it here until it's 25 years old. So those cars you just mentioned, even if there were Euro-specific versions, you could get some form of Golf, 911, even Defender for a few years. They were available here, and so they were just more widely available. What made this different is that Skyline GTR was basically a car built with Japan completely in mind. They really weren't concerned about other markets. There was really only Australia, got a couple of hundred cars. Later, a few years later, the UK got a couple of hundred cars, but this was a car for Japan.
That seems crazy to me. Yeah. Like, Japan has people, but it doesn't have like a zillion people. It seems like a worldwide release of a car seems like, hey, if we're going to make a car, let's make the car. Why? What was the premise of why this car was made for Japan? What makes Japan different that you can make a car just for them? And the presumed notion is that no one else is going to want it or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, the main thing is national pride and identity is very, very strong in Japan. And so things that are homegrown are very close to the heart in that country, no question. You know, we also get into it in the book a little bit, like the rise of the Japanese auto industry is really one of the main things that lifted that country out of the ashes after World War II. You know,
yeah.
And frankly, took the world by surprise. Nobody saw this coming. Everybody looked at that country as like, you know, incapable of producing things like that at that scale. So the fact that it did grow into the behemoth that it did, it was a very, very strong sense of pride for people. So Nissan knew that they would have strong demand for this car. They had no idea that it was going to be as strong as it was. They predicted a, for the R32 GTR in 89, they predicted a 5,000 unit production run, period, over a 4 or 5 year stretch. And they eventually ended up making over 60,000 models of the R32 on based on demand. And again,
yeah,
almost entirely sold in Japan. So
let's go back just a little bit. Let's rewind just a little bit. Why did they build this car? Why did Nissan go, okay, you know, Datsun's gone, whatever, we're moving on in the future. Why did they build this car? Because it's, you know, it's like a, it's a pretty nice car. And it does, when I think Nissan, I think like the skyline is over here, and then it's like Maximas and like Ultimas, everything else is over here, Pathfinders. That car is pretty dope. Like, why did they decide to build that as like, was it like a halo car thing? What was the reason for it?
Yeah, it's important for most Japanese car companies to have like a real moonshot car. And the Skyline has been a really important model throughout Nissan's history. But at this point, like throughout the 80s, there hadn't been a GTR. They killed it in the early 70s because of, you know, low demand and the oil crisis, things like that. So they went 16 years without a GTR. But by the time we got around to the mid 80s, late 80s, other car companies were really venturing into the supercar territory. Nissan felt like they were being left behind. They really wanted to bring back the GTR in a way that no one would expect. And so that was the premise. They really tried to push the envelope as hard as they could with the R32 GTR. And so what they were benchmarking was the Porsche 959, which is kind of astonishing to imagine, but
it's pretty crazy.
It truly was. They bought one and tore it down to really get into the nuts and bolts of how it was put together. And that is really what they were shooting for. They wanted to make a Nissan under the Nissan brand, which is very important, you know, caveat to this, that could conceivably be on that level or near to it.
Do you think they succeeded?
I mean, pound for pound for the money, yeah, no question. You look at how expensive the 959 was at the time, and the fact that the R32 GTR, for a reasonably successful but relatively normal business person, could afford this car, yeah, I think value-wise, yeah, there's no question.
So was the original Skyline something that was considered, I'm talking like early 70s, was that something that was considered really special the way that this one was?
No, Skylines were kind of normal sedans for a long time. And then in the late 60s, they came out with a GTR version, which is now affectionately called Hakoskas. It was four doors at first and then two doors. And it just was fantastic on the racetrack. And, you know, they were basically putting a race car motor into their regular sedan, and it took off. So they did the Hakoska for a few years. They came out with one version after that.
And that's the one that has like the little mirrors on the fender, right? The really beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next one in the early 70s was called the Ken Mary GTR. And that looks a lot like a Challenger. It looks like a muscle car, an American muscle car, which was partly on purpose at the time. But you know, due to a lot of factors, they didn't end up making very many, and then let the GTR name kind of sit by the wayside for over a decade.
So I think the 25 year rule is really, I agree with you, as you know, as I'm reading through the book and what you focused on, who is Robert Whittaker and John Sandy Walker? Talk me through kind of that section of the book, and because I think it's really critical to understanding why the GTR became, it was forbidden fruit, right?
Yeah, it was absolutely forbidden fruit, and the reason is this law. So you know, in the 80s there was this phenomenon of the gray market, which cars that weren't available in the US, you could bring them into the country and convert them to meet safety standards and emission standards. and be fine.
So that means like bringing in like a Mercedes or a Rabbit or something, and you got to pull the Euro bumpers off, you got to put the impact bumpers on. Was there like a, did the model that you were importing have to be one that was sold here? Like, did you, or could it be, because like, how would you convert, let's say the Skyline did exist, you know, in 86 or whatever it is, and you wanted to import the car, but there wasn't any of them sold here. How would you convert it over? Was that something that could even happen?
Yeah, it could have happened. You had to take it to a certified conversion shop, and they had to be able to show that they actually did the work. A lot of these conversion shops promised to do the work, took deposits for it, and then never did anything. So that was one of the issues. Automakers felt that these cars coming into the country were, first of all, vulturing their own U.S. dealership sales. And second of all, giving them, kind of tarnishing their name, because they might not have any of the work that they're supposed to have, and they could potentially be dangerous that way. I think what they were most concerned about was their bottom line, but you know, they predicated it on safety quite a bit. And the worry that these conversion shops were kind of backroom, underground shops that couldn't be trusted. Robert Whitaker was a congressman in Kansas, who you mentioned. Automakers were pressing the government to institute a law like the 25-year law for a long, long time, and had a lot of trouble gaining any traction. Eventually, in the late 80s, Robert Whitaker sponsored the bill that eventually became the Imported Vehicle Safety Act, which is now the 25-year law. He represented a very small town in the middle of Kansas, and proposed a number of bills during, I believe, his 12 years in his seat, but only three ever were passed into law. One renamed a lake near his district. One recognized like a National Health Awareness Week. And the third was the Imported Vehicle Safety Act of 1988, which is, I just found that astonishing. So I think clearly there is a reason that he was the one chosen to sponsor this bill. I'm not sure that anyone knows what the reason was. But the other person you mentioned, I think, probably plays a more critical role. And I was really proud to bring this story to light, because I don't think it's been told, or at least the gravity of its role hasn't really been given its due. Sandy Walker was a very prominent architect in Northern California, San Francisco area. He owned a gray market Mercedes sedan. And one day in, I believe, 84, the summer, he and his fiance were coming home from a wedding, and they had both been drinking. And at a very high rate of speed, his Mercedes left the road, smashed into a tree, spun out, and burst into flames. He was pulled out by, you know, a person that just happened to be in the area. His fiance did not make it out, and tragically died. Her name was Suzanne Zalonis. And she was 26 at the time. So pretty heart-wrenching story. Walker did test over the legal limit, of alcohol in his blood. So was charged with, manslaughter and driving under the influence.
Seems reasonable to me, honestly. Speeding, yeah. Drinking.
Yeah. After a trial, he was actually acquitted, which is just, I mean, it's pretty astonishing. The facts are pretty much right there. What his lawyer argued was that if the drinking was not a factor, his car had work done at a conversion shop. And he argued that that caused the brake system to fail, and caused the accident. And the jury found that, as a guy that works on cars,
I try to think to myself how that's possible. Like, what could they have been working on with conversion to do something to the ABS, or like, what could they have, you know, like, I think, what could they have ever touched? It doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah. There's a lot more interesting detail I wasn't able to go fully into the book, but, basically, the defense brought a witness who was a former open-wheel race car driver and had done some work with Ralph Nader in
oh god
in his landmark
unsafe at any speed
investigations. So, but at, you know, at that time, that was a very well-known, you know, process, and his name was well-known. And mm-hmm. so they brought him to testify on behalf of the fact that, you know, he thought this work had been done poorly and probably caused the accident. The prosecution could not counter that because the defense got access to the vehicle and the prosecution did not. So they couldn't really refute his testimony that, oh, I went under the hood.
How can he, don't you have discovery? Don't they have to get access to it?
Yeah, for some reason, only the defense was able to get access, and then the car either was destroyed or couldn't be found after that. So the jury
that sounds like a very, like a bunch of auto manufacturers got together and just like the electric motor stuff back in the day where they all conspired just to make sure that that thing disappeared, dude. Thing got thrown out of the back of a plane into the ocean.
The race car driver that gave this testimony had done consulting work for different automakers in the past. And so, you know, read into that whatever you want. But, you know, there was clearly an incentive to have conversion shops and the gray market blamed for this accident. And the underlying message being, if we keep allowing gray market cars to come into this country, you could be next. And the Walker's attorney said that directly to the jury. This could have been you, and it could be you next time. And so after he was acquitted, you know, there was a big public outroar. Mothers Against Drunk Driving were very, very upset and issued some pretty scathing remarks about, you know, the fairness of the justice system and the fact that they believed Walker should be in jail. But automakers very quickly jumped on this and said, see, we told you. The jury has clearly spoken, and they agree that gray market cars are dangerous. We need to pass a law immediately. And this is when they were finally able
to gain traction. How much money were they losing? The auto manufacturers generally, like how much, or the, probably not the manufacturers necessarily, but the dealer networks here were losing insane amounts of money, right?
The National Dealers Association was a major driver in this too. So Mercedes gets the brunt of the blame today. Like it's the 25-year law is pretty regularly called the law that Mercedes bought. It wasn't just them. They were, you know, suffering the most, I guess you could say. It was substantial. There were 60,000 cars being brought into the U.S. A year through the gray market. At one point, it tailed off. Actually, by the time the law passed, it was already pretty much dead. But Mercedes was losing money. Porsche was too. BMW was too. Lots of other companies were too. But it was chiefly Mercedes. And you're right, the Dealers Association pounced on this hard. They lobbied extensively in Congress. They hired, you know, tons of consultants to get this passed. And, you know, the death of Suzanne Zalonis is ultimately what got this over the finish line for them. Created the 25-year law in 1988, and then 9 months later, the R32 GTR comes out.
Was there any comment from Nissan of like, oh no, like, because they probably assumed that, hey, if anybody wants one of these in the United States, they can just import one. You know, if they want one, they can get one. So they really probably didn't really have a plan to have this car that they built for the Japanese market, like delivered to dealers and crash test the car and do all this other stuff, because they just would have been like, ah, just import it. Hire a guy, hire such and so, and he'll get you one.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't think they really had very much concern about U.S. sales at all. They already had, you know, U.S. dealers and U.S. sales set up for other things, and they didn't think Americans would be interested in this. And they, frankly, by that time, weren't interested in trying to chase what Americans wanted. They had kind of already tried that in the early 70s with their muscle car GTR, and it you know, that I think they learned from that that, like, if we try to tailor to other markets, we're going to get burned. So let's just do.
You think they were right?
What we do well. I mean, it proved out. You know.
The whole thing is we'll never know because it got you couldn't bring them in. So then the forbidden fruit thing. So everybody wanted one and they wanted to have one and have what nobody else had and stuff like that. If it had been legal and they had sold the car here, do you think that they were right in not bringing the car here, or do you think the car would have sold and done well?
That's a good question. I've never thought about that. I think they would have had trouble. I mean, in 89, the kind of cars that were selling were not really like sports cars. And this would have been expensive, you know. And I think a lot of Americans would have kind of turned their nose up at that time. We didn't really consider a Nissan. And Toyota already had the Supra and other performance cars. And there were, you know, Japanese performance cars. But I think that would have been a hard sell.
Do you know how much I don't have any idea what it would have cost here. I think what was a Celica GTS like, or a Supra, was it like $8,000, $9,000 or something like that? Seven, somewhere in there?
Something like
that.
What
would a Skyline have cost?
I mean, for a GTR?
Yeah.
It would have been a lot. It would have been, yeah, I don't know, $40,000 probably, which at the time.
No shit, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, okay, so how much was a 959?
Oh, hundreds of thousands. Like,
okay, so let's look
at
959 original MSRP. Let's see if it was 431,000 Deutschmarks. It was $225,000. I think, would there have been like this American like blinders on like, I am not paying $40,000 for a Nissan. There is no way. I am not doing that.
Yeah, I think so. I think by the late 80s, people were starting to come around to the idea that the Japanese auto industry knew what it was doing, but that was still kind of in its infancy. People still had trouble getting their minds around that.
Yeah. So I remember seeing, maybe we used to have this road around here called University Avenue, and we called it Uni. We'd all get in our cars. For me, it was an old Volkswagen Rabbit with a hot motor in it. We would drive down to Uni and we would park our cars, and different cars would show up in the lot and they'd pull and they'd go off and they'd go do street racing and stuff like that. I never did any of that stuff because my car was slow and I didn't want to be embarrassed. But these dudes would, you know, come around. There was a guy that his name was DC Nate, and he had like a Civic hatchback with like a million horsepower. And then there was a guy that had a Skyline. And this is 20 years ago. Okay. So this car was illegal. It was not legal to have this car here. Yet here this guy was driving this thing around, and it was awesome. Every time you saw that car, you're like, no way, how was that possible? That is the coolest shit ever. Again, forbidden fruit, you couldn't have it. How did he get that car here? What's the story with what it was like to get a Skyline and drive it on public roads, even though it was illegal? How did it happen?
There were lots of different ways to do it. Some places imported the body and the engine or powertrain separately and then just joined them when they were here, which is... It's legal to import them like that. It's once you join them together, it's illegal. But you can legally import one part and then the other part because they're just parts.
Okay.
So you could do that.
So is there like a part number for a chassis?
Yes.
Like,
yeah. And they can match it up from what came out of the factory. You could also get it from Canada and then bring it over the border and tell the guards that it's a Nissan Z, a 300ZX or something like that, and hope they don't check. But the most common way...
What happened if you got busted? Like, you're at the border, you're in Toronto, whatever, you're sitting in your Skyline that you just paid, I don't know, probably $80,000 for it, and you import it from Japan, and you're just sweating your nuts off. Just like in Initial D, where the dudes are always sweating, you're just in there, you're just like a bucket of sweat. Like that meme where the guy's just wiping his face off all the time. And you pull up to the stop, the little arm comes down. They're just like, hey, what's up? What are you doing? Where'd you get this car? And they go, dude, that is not a Z. That is not an Altima. That is a Skyline. What happens to that guy?
Oh, it gets seized immediately. And then whatever happens to the person, I mean, it kind of depends on the agency that's doing the arresting. But it was probably, I mean, I don't... For that, like one car, I don't think it was like jail time. It was probably like a pretty hefty fine and like, don't do this again. But
there
most
were
common
people
way...
that did go to jail though, right?
Sorry?
Was there anybody that did go to jail for, you know, trying to import these cars and broke the law and ended up in prison?
Yeah. Actually, the harshest case that I found was a gray market converter in the 80s. Once the Skyline stuff happened, there was a huge frenzy to like chase down the people who were doing this. I didn't find anything that was like real hard prison time, but there were cases where people were facing dozens and dozens of years in jail and massive, massive fines. But that was really more for headlines. And then once it actually came to handing down the punishment, it was much less than originally.
Yeah, you're going to be sweeping up the streets behind the church.
And yeah,
on your that kind of thing.
Yeah,
but so
I want to say real quick, the most common way that people brought him into the country was just put him in a container, stuff it with a bunch of paper towels or something to cover it up, and then cross your fingers and bring it in through the ports, because the amount of shipping containers that are actually checked is minuscule, like incredibly small. Even X-ray, it's very, very small. So you do have pretty good odds of getting whatever you want in.
So was there any way to drive it legally? Was there any way to make that happen where it was like, this is okay?
Yeah, there are a few different provisions that you could do. Show and display is a big one, which was actually started when Bill Gates wanted to bring a 959 into the country. He had his lawyer draw up the plans for what became the show and display law. There are restrictions to that. I think it's only 2,500 miles per year that you can do. And there are a lot of hoops you have to jump through, but it can be done. Motorex is a company in California in the late 90s and early 2000s that did convert Skyline GTRs. And there was a federal process to convert them, to bring them into the country. You had to jump through tons of hoops and spend untold sums of money. They're the only company to this day that was able to navigate that and do it. Eventually it all crumbled and fell to pieces. But yes, there was a way to do it. Only one company has ever done it.
And what the book tells me is that all of this was done for the manufacturers. So the safety thing is bullshit. We both know that with that 500 SEC that went off the road, the dude was drunk. I'm sure there was a little bit of a lack of regulatory oversight with some of these cars being brought in. I'm sure there was, but I find it hard to believe that they became unsafe. So then the entire restriction on this, and it seems like the mentality of we are going to restrict this and then go after the people that are importing the cars has created, seems like the inception of the mentality of going after people these days with loud exhaust. Like that entire anti enthusiast sentiment of getting people, when it's just such like an extreme minority of people, even if you're talking 60,000 cars a year, there are millions and millions of cars sold per year. So it is still like a fraction of anybody that has anything to do with anything, and enthusiasts end up being the ones that suffer.
Yeah, and you could say the same about the emissions side of this as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the funny thing is, we say that these are, you know, federally outlawed for 25 years because they would be unsafe on the road and their emissions don't meet our standards. But then once they turn 25, okay,
it's
they're
okay.
Fine.
Yeah, it's no problem.
None of those safety concerns that we had for the previous 25 years, we're not concerned about that anymore, even though, you know, cars weigh 10 times as much now and are twice the size. It's totally fine.
Yeah, that's, I had that in my notes. It says, are we just kicking the can down the road with the 25-year rule? What's the actual difference between importing something with 7,501 miles on it tomorrow and something with 7,501 miles on it in 25 years?
Yeah, if it
sounds, literally makes no sense.
If it sounds like these numbers are completely arbitrary, it's because they are.
Oh, man. So how much did pop culture have to do with the Skyline's notoriety?
Yeah, it was massive. There, you know, it's been well documented, the GTR having major roles in media, Initial D, Gran Turismo, various Fasts and Furiouses. I think it's a combination of a lot of those things. It's you know, people can distill it down to, oh well, the phenomenon has to do with it being forbidden fruit, which is true, but it's not just that. It's that combined with we were also being inundated with how amazing this car is. People who were into Japanese magazines, it was dominating enthusiast magazines at the time. So if you were getting that kind of stuff here, you know, you saw it everywhere. If you watched Initial D, you saw it everywhere. If you played Gran Turismo, it was the car. And then if you saw certain Fast and Furious where you know, Paul Walker's sliding around in these things or under the hood building his own. You combine that with the fact that you can't have it. That is what really set it off, I think.
Why did it take them so long? I want to jump back to pop culture in a second, but why did it take Nissan so long to go, oh, maybe we should sell the fucking thing in America and make a car? What took so damn long?
So Nissan went through a pretty dark period in the mid to late 90s. They were in major, major trouble. So they really had bigger things to worry about. It's frankly a miracle that there is an R33 and an R34. Like, other competitive Japanese sports cars basically stopped before that point. Like, you know, we didn't get another Supra for a while. The NSX just kind of stayed long in the tooth for a long time. The changes they made to the 33 and 34 really couldn't be justified on a spreadsheet, on a, you know, financially.
Yep.
But they did it anyway because they felt it was important to their brand and their biggest fans. They knew at that point there was enough in the U.S. to justify bringing it here, but they would have had to overhaul it completely. So that eventually became the R35. Another vehicle that, you know, it's just incredible that they were able to do that, because their bottom line by the year 2000, 2001 was just dreadful. It was a nightmare. And really, the only reason that Nissan survived that period is that Carlos Ghosn became CEO and immediately started transforming the way that they do all levels of their business. And that was able to create enough R&D money to create the R35.
So speaking of the underground kind of pop culture phenomenon, I think of like Top Secret. Watching the Top Secret was I can't remember his name for some reason, but he always had a cigarette hanging out of his mouth. And then the Hashira. Tell me about that, and maybe a little bit about the Yoshida special and how it competed and was a contrast for Porsche and the Skyline.
Yeah, man, you're touching on a lot of things there. The Japan sports car scene in the 70s and 80s and then kind of culminating in the 90s was really something special from the way that people talk about it. And it started, like you mentioned, with the Hashira in the 70s, just being all about driving all the time and doing whatever they could. Modifying your car in Japan at that time was basically illegal. It was looked at as something that the Bosozoku gangs would do. Like, it basically marked you as an outlaw. And so it was illegal to put fenders on a car, to put a spoiler on a car, to kind of upgrade its performance in any way. These people found ways to do it anyway. And really prioritized driving skill in their clubs instead of being, you know, hooligans and just being out there to cause trouble. But they got lumped in with that criminal aspect. So it took a long time, basically the entire decade of the 80s, to kind of shed that negative image that they had. But the result was, by the end of that, you had these modification shops that were growing in popularity, and the biggest ones were becoming famous. Things like Mines, June, Top Secret, as you mentioned, and at the head of Top Secret was Smokey Nagata.
Smokey Nagata. Yeah, those videos were so cool. I remember, like, you didn't have the internet. Like, somebody had like some bootleg DVD that you would watch that on and just be like, holy shit, what is this?
Or rip awesome. It on LimeWire.
yep.
And HKS, I forgot to mention too, which really operates now almost like an automaker. It's less of a custom shop and more of a its own, you know, manufacturing enterprise. That passion fueled by those drivers led to, you know, an industry that could support itself. And now those guys are famous. You know, people fly across the ocean to visit those shops and buy a strut bar from Mines or, you know, anything from Top Secret.
Right. I mean, that seems like such a legendary time in the JDM car culture. You know, it seems like this really enigmatic, ethereal period of time, because, you know, we're on episode like 500 of this podcast. I've been trying for probably about 300 episodes to bring someone on from that period of time that was there and lived it. And then people are kind of like, I don't really want to. It just seems like just really, really mysterious, the entire thing.
Yeah, I think that's part of the fun for them. But they do come from an era where it was looked down upon, and they're still very nervous about it. Like anything you read about Racing Team Midnight, or a lot of people know it as Midnight Club, they're still very cagey about everything. And I think that's part of the fun for them. They like it being like an inside joke kind of thing. But they also, they just don't think other people are ready for the full story yet. So we'll see if that comes out in the future.
So why did you write this book? You know, why did you decide, you know, we learned about all this stuff. Why did it need a book?
I couldn't believe it didn't exist already. I think the Skyline GTR story exists in bits and pieces all over the place. And I wanted to see what would happen if we actually tried to find answers to some of these rumors. Actually tried to get some detail on the scandals that happened and then put it all in one place. I felt that it deserved that. I think the most interesting car stories are what happens when really passionate people follow their obsession all the way to the end. And it happens a lot in the car world. We're not great at documenting it. And I think that it deserves to be documented because we have a ton of books about the history of the Mustang or the story of, you know, this one particular, you know, model in time, you know, but the thing that makes cars so fun is the people. And you hear people say that all the time. Like, it's not like, I don't go to Cars and Coffee for the cars, I go for the people. But like, we don't have books like that. And you have it in other stuff. Like, I'm a big sports fan, and that's how a lot of sports books are done. And the way we write about music is different now. Food is different now. Like, everything is about culture and people and like the way that these things bring us together. And this car has the most colorful people I've ever seen in the car world. And again, there are lots of other cars that have similar things, but this one is just, it's just completely unique. Like, there is not a story like this. And I think car people deserve to have stories like this treated seriously and documented.
Yeah, I think the thing with books too is, you know, we live in a world of the internet, right? And you can get like a little piece here, a little piece there, maybe an unsourced piece here. You saw this on Instagram there. Well, there's no compendium of anything anymore. Everything is just these little bits and pieces. And I commend you for writing the book. The link is going to be in the show notes. Go take a look. I read a bunch. Ryan's a great writer, and there's some really good stories in there. Where can they find the book other than whatever link you're going to give me? How do you want people to find it in case they're just listening?
So the best way is to go to CarraraBooks.com, CarraRa. There you can find the standard version, Cult of GTR. We also have a limited edition called the Wangan Edition. That's 250 units only. Each one's numbered and signed. And that's the only place to find that one. But the story in the both books is the same. So if you are just interested in the story, you can find that anywhere. It's available on, wherever books are sold online.
All right, man. I really appreciate your time today. I appreciate you hanging out. Where can people follow you? What else? You're a journalist, right? Hold on a second. You're a journalist, right?
Yeah.
Who do you write for? What do you do other than this?
So I've freelanced in a bunch of different places. I've had pieces in Road and Track, The Verge, Car and Driver. I was with Edmunds for 3.5 years until recently. I spent the past year really honing in on the book. So what's next?
They probably were like, dude, why are you working on this book so much? And then Edmunds, they said, yeah, man, you're working on your book too much. Time to let you go or what?
it wasn't quite like that, but I mean, this is my second book, so I knew what it would take, and I wanted to do it properly. Yeah. So I tried to dedicate the time that I felt it deserved. But yeah, we'll figure out what's coming next. I'm trying to map out my 2024 right now and see what other projects we got cooking.
Well, I look forward to whatever's next, man. Keep in touch.
Thanks very much, Chris. I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.